All right, welcome back to another episode of the Sunstone Podcast. I'm your host, John Larson, and we're here in the studio in the Marmalade District of Salt Lake City. Here, we're just north of West High. This was a scary part of town when I was a kid, but we're right in the shadow of the Everlasting Hills, right down from the Capitol. The Sunstone, we were just walking through the building. I was showing you guys all the weird artifacts and things around here. It's a beautiful place. We're rebuilding it. We're going to have an open house here in a couple of weeks or months when we finish. We're in the middle of a remodel. You guys saw the remodel going on. I think it's going to be a nice little space. Let me give you an introduction to what we're talking about today. A few weeks ago, I posted on some of the Facebook groups. I took a 2-year break from Facebook. And I jumped back on a couple months ago because of this podcast, and I want to be able to talk to people and hear what they're thinking and saying in this space. And I posted a thread on a couple of different groups to ask people who'd been out of the church for a long time, people who'd processed through their sort of rage stage or whatever it is of coming out the other side, what advice would they give to people who are freshly coming out of the church? And we got some really fantastic feedback from a lot of thoughtful people. So for today, I've gathered in some of the great ones, people who I really admire. I'm gonna tear up a little bit here. People who I really admire who have been working in this community for a long time, who have seen it all. And you're here. So, and we're going to do that. We're going to talk about advice, unsolicited advice to people who are freshly leaving the church, because people who are freshly leaving the church don't think they need any advice. So maybe someone will listen. But first of all, Wendy, thank you for coming. Wendy has been an anchor in Davis. Now, Davis County is the county right north of Salt Lake, one of the main primary bedroom communities of Salt Lake, of Utah. And you have been an anchor, you and your husband, Jim, who's here, have been an anchor of that community for a long, long time. And old friends of mine, and it's great to see you. Wendy, welcome.
Thanks. It's good to see you too, John.
Well, thank you. That's wonderful. And then we have Letty Rockwell. Hey, Letty.
Hello.
Now, Letty is this brilliant, sensitive person. And she's got a husband named Greg, who used to be on the old Mormon Expression, who's got sort of the loudmouth of the two of you.
Oh no!
but
not here to defend himself.
And Greg is a wonderful guy and a great friend who I love dearly. But Letty is the charm of the couple. And if you get the chance to meet the two, she'll be the person who's just effervescent and smiling and glowing in the corner. But you can't let her beauty and grace and charm disarm you, because she has a sharp mind. Letty, thank you for coming.
Oh gosh, John, I don't even know what to say to all that, but thank you.
And
so good to be here.
And then and you, Steve, you've got we found out you have family connections back. You were in high school with my wife.
No. She grew up in the same town that I grew up in.
Oh, San Jose. But when you were kids.
Yeah. She was a little younger, and so I didn't really. I knew her sister.
Oh,
I knew
okay.
Lisa.
Oh, you hung out with Lisa.
Lisa was like a couple years younger than me.
This of course is the voice of the one and only Steve Holbrook, who has been one of the anchors of Utah County, which is the other bedroom county. Letty and I are in Salt Lake County, so you guys are down in Utah County, which of course is the mecca of Mormonism. It's sort of like it's
the effective center
of the Mormon right, because you know BYU is there and all that sort of stuff. And it's always been a kind of a turbulent place where people are leaving the church, and because if you go up to Davis County and Ogden and some of those other areas, yeah, the church is ever present. We are in Utah, but it doesn't define people as much as Utah County. So
young Mormon families get started in Provo.
They all do, yes. So you have been, you and Chris have been anchors of that community for a long time. You guys were involved were you running through Calm in the early days?
Yeah, no, when we got involved, it was called the Utah Valley Post-Mormons, mm-hmm. And it still is called that. And that group kind of took over a classic support meeting that was originally called Calm, mm-hmm. that you were involved in establishing before I ever showed up.
Yeah, that was around 2007. There were three of us who started Calm, which was and there were groups before us and groups before them. And when you peel back the strata of ex-Mormonism, it goes all the way back to 1830, really, is just one generation after the other after the other. You go read Mormonism Unveiled in 1834, and you'll see that it's like the early version of the CES letter.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of folks who have gone before us, and you know, the intention here is that we're going to give you ideas of what you could look out for. I mean, this is a new part of your life suddenly.
Right. And you guys were involved in setting up the Oasis community here in Salt Lake. No,
I was on the periphery of that, but watched it happen. Also, a really good thing
for
the post-Mormon community.
So you're all here because, I really respect your opinions, but it's been a while. I think I went to church the last time sincerely. I mean, I've been to baptism stuff since, but last time I went to church sincerely was in 2005. Wendy, now I remember you were kind of half in and half out because you still supported the Young Women's for a while.
Well, no, I started having my faith crisis back in 2000, but decided I didn't want to be in one of those families where one person was active and the other wasn't. So I just kind of set a bunch of things on the shelf. And then December of 2007, my husband came home from a business trip and had learned all kinds of things about the church that he hadn't heard of before. So he had come home from church late Saturday night. We went to church he came home from the business meeting late Saturday night. We went to church the next morning. It was December of 2007. And by the end of the week, we had talked our way out and we haven't gone back sincerely since.
Hello, Letty. When was the last time you went to church?
Sincerely? Because I think the last time I went was the Wear Pants to Church Day to help support Stephanie. But so I guess it probably was. Greg had been having a faith crisis for probably 4 to 5 years before he finally stopped going in February 2011. And within a very short time, you know, I got on the same page with him. And so probably the last time I went sincerely was sometime in March 2011. And yeah, I was in the primary presidency and I was like, oh, I can't do this anymore. I've got to get out. So, and yeah, my first kind of post-Mormon meeting, I met Jim and Wendy that night at Sean and Stacy's house.
Oh yeah.
Sean and Stacy Lovitz. And, you know, I love these guys. It's glad to be here with Wendy today. So.
And for you guys, for you.
Let me see. The last time I went to church was the end of 1991. I had my faith crisis at the beginning of 1991.
So it's been a while. And one of the reasons this is true, I was trying to think of good metaphors. If you wanted to describe cancer survivors and what their culture is like and what they're like and how they live their lives, you wouldn't go to the Huntsman like you know, where you're getting chemo drips. You wouldn't go up to that room and ask the people how they've processed cancer through their life. And I think one of the most unfortunate things about dealing with ex-Mormons is those people who are fresh leaving the church define for us, and I've been guilty of this as a commentator, we use those people to define the experience of being a former Mormon. And so often, because they're in this really a difficult situation, and it's really hard to explain to people who haven't gone through a faith crisis what it's like. For some people, it's about like going through a divorce. For other people, it's like going through a death in the family. For other people, it's like discovering you have cancer. I mean, there's a lot of people who, it's true, they wake up one day and say, I'm no longer a Mormon, yippee. But most people say, I'm no longer Mormon, yippee. And inside there's this horror show of trying to reprocess who they are.
Yeah, no, I agree. It really kind of depends on how much of your identity was provided to you by the church. If it's a good percentage, now having the church kind of disassemble itself in front of you and crumble, you don't have much of a foundation to stand on. And so it kind of depends on how much of your identity you've worked on as like, who would you be if the church weren't there? And had done any work like that. I had. And so when I finally had my realization, like, wow, one possibility for all of this is it isn't true. I was trained very well that you don't even consider that seriously, that question.
Right.
Ever.
No. No. And so the first question I had was, well, okay, if it's not true, what if I'm wrong? What if it actually is true and I've been deceived? Because latter days, very elect will be deceived. And it was terrifying to consider, well, it seems like it's definitely not true, but what if I'm wrong?
See, you were doubting your doubts. So that was
I was doubting my doubts before it was cool.
The prescribed path.
Yeah, and at the end of it, I found myself surrounded by a pile of metaphorical rubble, and I was trying to, you know, look at each brick and say, okay, do I believe this or do I not believe this? And I think it's important to sift through that because we did learn a lot of positive, good things and a lot of great morals and values. And I don't think you need to necessarily throw all of that out just because some of this other stuff isn't true. And so I think it's important to sift through that and figure out what's good and what's salvageable in your belief system.
I really like that you say it's a pile of rubble, because we're conditioned by the church to talk in this simple binary. Is the church true? Is the church not true? And ex-Mormons do it the same, which if you think about it for more than half a second, it's a ridiculous statement. Churches are institutions. There's no way they can be true or false. You know, it's like an argument of whether blue is true or not. There's nothing there. And when you say it's a pile, it really is, because the church and our culture, because we're if you grew up in a Mormon community, you have the community elements, you have the Mormon culture and heritage and mythology and lore, and you know, the Bigfoot is Cain and all that kind of stuff. And then you have the practice, and then you have the belief, and you have what Salt Lake City's saying. And it's this very, very complex thing. And the problem is when you leave the church, it's like the foundation from that whole thing drops. And you're left with this big pile of stuff that you have to sort through.
Absolutely. Do you bleep things?
I can bleep. You can bleep. Swear if you want.
Okay. I was like, oh no. So early on with Greg, when he had left, and we had this month of just, we've always pretty much been on the same page. And so we had this month of like, where are we? Because he suddenly was researching and he's finding things out about Joseph Smith, and he read the stuff on the Book of Abraham, and his mind was blown. He didn't come across any historical stuff. He was just kind of reasoning stuff out and going, "This, none of this makes sense. None of this feels true." And so when he found it and wanted to share it with me, he's like, this isn't true, you know? And I said to him, "F the truth," because I think I kind of realized how relative it all was, and I'm like, I was trying to piece out what does true mean here anymore? Like if the church is not the capital T true church, then what does any of this mean? And so he has said to me so many times, "I'm so glad you said that, the truth," because he's more of a black and white thinker, I think, and I'm less. I live in that gray area a little bit more, and so I think it helped to help him kind of look at that and really kind of break things down a little bit. So
I think there's a whole other notion of what is true for people in the church. It isn't necessarily that binary, is it God's true church, but is it true for them? Like, is a wheel true? Because if you have a wobbly wheel, it doesn't really get you, it's not functioning well. And so you true a tire to kind of get it to go straight. And in that regard, for many people, the church actually is true, like a true wheel. It works for them.
Well, and on that note, Mormons themselves are much more nuanced thinkers. We always talk about them as like they're all robots. And there's an insult that ex-Mormons use all the time. They call the church the morgue, you know, after the Borg, implying that all Mormons are like unified in thinking. And we as ex-Mormons know better, because we were Mormons. But at this point, at this flashpoint where Mormons meet ex-Mormons and people switch sides, we narrow it down into this black and white thinking. All of us do. When ex-Mormons are not nearly as black and white as they pretend to be about the church, and Mormons are not nearly as black and white as they pretend to be about the church, but there's something about that crisis of faith, that definition of apostasy, that throws people into a combative sort of mood. You know, it's like when I hear people debating abortion, to pick a terrible example, when I hear the sides, you know, pro-life, pro-choice, well, they're both right to a degree. Like, we don't really want to have to, you know, end the life of a fetus. No one really wants that. And no one really wants to take away all the rights of women. I mean, not most people. But you get this, the way the debate has been framed, it forces us into these false dichotomies. And the very act of leaving the church, because of the way the church has talked about apostasy so long, forces us into playing this script, even with our families, that's ridiculous. And nobody really fits into it, but we just fall right into that trap.
I think a lot of people feel like they're forced to show perfect faith. They feel like they can't admit that something doesn't sit right with them. And I think that's a really hard thing for Mormons to admit. And so I think that's part of the reason that there is this argument between both sides, is it's hard for each side to admit the other has a point.
Go ahead.
No, you.
I have heard people express that so often, where they have a family member that they were able to gripe about the church with, but at the moment that they have to declare, I don't believe this anymore, that other family member, that other friend, you know, they pull on their true believing Mormon britches and they say no, and you can't have that conversation with them anymore because they have to be the stalwart now that you're the apostate.
Well, that happened in my family, where we would get together and do innocent griping about the church.
Right.
And in a later conversation with my father, because I didn't come out to them right away, and I didn't come out to them because I didn't know a way to do it without breaking my mom's heart.
Yeah.
So it's a deeply personal thing. And when you're going through that transition, your opinion is changing. You don't even know what you believe. And so even to sit down and articulate what it is that your problems are is extremely difficult. And I remember my dad telling me later, he said, well, we knew you were serious, you know, when there's something about the tenor of what I was saying changed. And then so what happened in the family is we just stopped talking about the church. And I have never tried to impose my belief of the church on my family. And my family hasn't either. For my most immediate family, especially my mom and dad, they've been fantastic. So we just went radio silent. And there were some awkward years where we had nothing to talk about, because the thing that was the most important to them, I mean, I'm here like recording this podcast doing, I was the most read in church history, but no one's going to talk to me. Matter of fact, my parents, and we've laughed about this since, every year they'd give a church history book to all their kids for Christmas, and we would all just put it on the shelf. But then I entered a phase where I actually read all those books, and then they stopped giving them to me because I took them too seriously, or I actually read them.
I don't know.
And you kept buying more.
And I kept buying more. Yeah, but I don't mean that as an insult. I mean, they were doing the best they could. But how do you even talk about the church when one is framed, in this case me, as an apostate and a betrayer? I was a turncoat. I was somebody who left the family tradition. And that's true. I did. I broke it.
Yeah, it's real. It's like tectonic plates, right? I mean, the fissure that kind of shows up in what used to be a homogeneous plate, there's now this fissure. And there's either friction going toward each other, which kind of, you've seen that happen, or you pull the plates apart. They're going in different directions. But regardless, there's some residue that you have to deal with. And that's a difficult thing that we all have gone through. And there's a spectrum of ways of dealing with this that was covered in the threads online pretty well, I thought.
Well, I'm glad you bring up spectrum, because people process it different ways. For some people, the act of leaving the church brings on a full-on case of PTSD, just as if they were, you know, combat shell-shocked in Iraq. It is real, and there you can talk, and we'll bring them on. The therapists who are used to dealing with PTSD, for some people, they feel an overwhelming sense of betrayal. They just feel like they were screwed over, and there's other people, it's just they process it as just this loss. You know, I framed it out as if you got divorced, you were in the middle of a very difficult divorce to somebody who's dying. You know, it's just like you're feeling all the emotions. And what's funny is when you take this group of people and they all might be saying the same thing, but emotionally inside, they are all feeling very intense feelings from very different things and reacting in ways that other people don't understand. You know, I'm sure you've all been through the situation in your life where some a loved one is dying and you see it coming. You know it's coming. And you prepare yourself emotionally for it, and you can imagine how you feel. And then the moment when she dies, you feel things that you did not, you couldn't prepare yourself for, that you can't control your emotions that way. And leaving the church is very much that way. You can't control how you emotionally react.
I actually had no idea that there were elements that hadn't been processed yet, but in... when was it? It was one of the mass resignations that we did.
Yes.
And there was a guy, the MTV staff was there because there was a someone on the verge of becoming a post-Mormon on their show.
Right.
And I remember I was so busy with helping to set that thing up, I didn't really hear his talk. And I listened to it later in a video kind of thing, replay. And I ended up sobbing because there was an element of the church that I hadn't really mourned that I had lost until what that young man said resonated so strongly with me that I was sobbing, missing some wonderful things that used to be in my life that weren't there anymore.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's part of who we are. I mean, for most of us were in the church well into our 30s. So our formal years, not only of education, but of being married, of raising your kids, of really the years that shape who you are as a person, the church was integrated. And I take a lot of heat now from ex-Mormons when I say, you're still a Mormon. And they do not like that at all. But you all can see it. Because when you meet the, you know, I call them the freshies, the ones who are fresh coming out of the church, they are so Mormon in their thinking, as is expected. I do not mean that as an insult. Because
no, it's a thought process. It's a way that we've been taught. It's how it's our worldview. And so I think you take that same worldview, but you're applying it to a different way. And a lot of times people do change that thinking, but we all do approach that world from the same worldview we did before.
You have to. There's no other choice.
That's the only thing you know.
That's who you are. So yeah. What you can do is you can invert, and that's what a lot of people do in the first stages. They just start inverting everything. I couldn't drink coffee before. I must drink coffee now. I couldn't drink alcohol before. I must drink alcohol now.
Not just coffee and alcohol, but all the coffee and all the alcohol. It's not like a little bit. It's not moderate. It's all in. Because we were all out.
This whole new world that you had no idea about.
Right.
And it's intoxicating and seductive and fun. And it does help define you. But you're coming at it from a reactive stance as a Mormon. And that's really hard to identify in yourself.
It's just two different angles on free agency. Before, you were free to go the wrong path. But you knew it was the wrong, you know, I mean, there was a right path and you were obviously wrong. So the notion of what's right and wrong is no longer provided by the church. And so you need to go explore what does it mean for you. That's the, I was 33 when I had that final, that thought of like, oh my gosh, it might not be true. And I thought, I finally arrived on the planet. I'm actually now standing on my own two feet. It's up to me, right? So that whole notion of agency, I've got freedom to go do anything I want, but I also own everything I go do.
That's so true. And that feeling is exhilarating. But I think the darkest part about being an ex-Mormon, especially those first 2 years, is there is this immense pressure on you to show that your life is better.
Definitely.
Because the narrative you've been hearing your whole life is the wages of sin are real. And apostates, they turn away because they want to sin, but their life ends up in ruin. Now, let's face it. Life is hard, and none of us are getting out alive. So odds are somebody close to you is going to get cancer. Somebody is going to die. There's going to be accidents. There's going to be job loss.
Lots of divorces.
Divorces. But those happen everywhere.
Right.
And there's so much pressure on ex-Mormons to show externally. I remember feeling this. I remember being told by a close relative, she said, we don't want to give you guys extra help. You know, like give old furniture. Because we don't want to help you succeed in something you're not supposed to be doing. But now I'm externalizing that, and I don't mean to, because I want to really talk about internally. You put an immense amount of pressure on yourself to show the world that this is not hard. And it really does kick the underpinning out from your marriage, from your career, from everything. And but you have this pressure to show that not only are you unaffected by leaving the church, but everything gets better. You have to say everything gets better.
Right. Well, when we were Mormon, we were told to be perfect. We were supposed to be perfect. And so I think achieving that perfection is equally, if not more important, to show that, no, you are doing the right thing because you're rewarded for correct behavior. So I think it's so important to show, yes, what I did was right. Look how great my life is now.
I just have this memory of being at Bear Lake with a little bit of my family, some of my friends, and Greg was, you talk about the different ways we process. I think I was sad. I think Greg was angry for a while. And I remember, you know, the thing that he threw himself into was reading and listening to podcasts. And I remember one of my friends saying, gosh, he's just so angry, you know, and they were very believing. And I think there was this, like, you know, that the scripture runs through their heads. Wickedness never was happiness. That's why he's so angry, because he's left the church and he's got this dark countenance. And it was just the processing that needed to happen. He was, you know, 4 months out, 5 months out at that point. So, oh my gosh, there was all of this stuff that he needed to work through. We did not stay in that place forever. You know, it was pretty short. But when people are still on the inside of the church looking at you leaving, they are looking for anything to continue to believe as they believe. And well, that's, you know,
it's tricky. And you guys have been around long enough. When you leave the church, you feel victimized by the members of the church. And don't get me wrong, there's some victimization that happens when you have a faith that says people leave the church are apostates because they want to sin, and da, 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 there's going to be some broken eggs there. But I think for a lot of us, when we were fresh out, it was hard to fully grasp the amount of social or violence that we were doing to those around us, that they had to process it too, and in ways that were very difficult for them. And unfortunately, the only advice they get is to turn you into a monster.
Right.
You are broken, and someday the adversary will chasten you and you'll come back to the church. But, you know, I think about my mother and all the mothers out there who they were raised to raise children unto the Lord. They were raised to send kids off to the temple. And what I did when I left the church is I broke my mother's heaven. I took heaven away from my mother. She can't have it. Because her heaven was to be reunited with her family and live eternally. And what that does to my mother is it impacts her sense of self-worth. It took away her sense of what she was here on this world to accomplish. And that's devastating to her on levels that, I mean, she can't understand everything I went through. I mean, I cannot understand everything she went through. But we're both victims of this. And I think there's so much anger that's righteous indignation. I'm not trying to say the anger that ex-Mormons feel is not well-deserved, but it's a form of social violence, and it impacts all these relationships around us.
Yeah, it's usually taken very personally if you say something negative about the church to within earshot of someone who's a believer. It hurts them. It's they're being attacked because it's such a part of our identity. It makes so much sense.
All right, so let's get into the advice.
Advice.
You know, the number one piece of advice that I've learned to give people, and I saw came up in these threads, as we had a lot of great people who've been out for a long time. If I was going to start summing up, the first piece of advice is slow down. I think you know, you talked about it with Greg. I felt that, you know, as I just started reading and reading and reading, and you just want to see how deep the rabbit hole went. And of course, because the Mormon Church has cleaned up its history, rewritten so much of it, put it in Sunday school manuals that really doesn't match the real history. If you're interested in that sort of thing, stumbling onto Mormon history is this amazing treasure trove of weirdness. And it can just suck you in ways that are delightful and exhilarating, and can offer, for a lot of us during that phase, we neglected everything because we were just reading one book after the other and binging on podcasts. We were talking about that beginning of the podcast. I've had many people who said to me, you know, they went on a business trip, I feel guilty about this, and downloaded my podcast and spent 14 hours listening to it and came back a completely different person in the middle of a faith crisis.
Oh, man.
You know, because it's like, oh, what am I going to listen to? Oh, this sounds fun. You know? but slow down. So the reason is you feel this imperative to find a solution. You're in this faith spot. It, whatever reason, it falls out from underneath you. And I think the rush that I'm talking about in time frame that a lot of ex-Mormons feel is they want to resolve that tension because it doesn't feel good. And they want to resolve it as quickly as they can. But the advice that most people, or that I hear most often from people who've been out for a long time, saying, it's on your own time scale. There's not a hurry. But that hurry comes from us wanting to get rid of the pain.
We had been in the same neighborhood in Draper for several years. And so, you know, we'd seen the flux of the neighborhood. People moved in, people moved out. But, you know, we were known as this stalwart couple, as we have always been. We have never been the inactive people. We were never, you know, kind of on the fringe. We were the people holding, you know, not huge callings. Greg was never in a bishopric or anything like that, but elders quorum and, you know, in young women's and primary and things like that. So, you know, we were people that people looked at and like, oh, good marriage and good people, and you can count on them for things. And so to suddenly be the people that were out, my number one thought, my first thought was, we have to get out of this neighborhood. It was like, we have to move. Obviously, we have to move. We cannot stay here because, you know, what would people think of us? And I don't think that I'm someone that's always so worried about what people think, but I just didn't see how it was going to work out for us to stay with these neighbors who had known us for, you know, 5-6 years.
I swear everybody that leaves, if they're in Utah, they want to move. And I kind of think that's part of it. So I would say don't make any rash decisions like moving out of your house or moving out of the state within the first couple of months. Give yourself time to process it.
Let the emotions settle a little bit, right? I mean, that's the real key in slowing down.
Yeah, you don't need the stress of moving on top of dealing with all of these new thoughts and feelings. But everybody wants to. I swear, everybody wants to move as soon as they figure out what's going on.
Part of it is, The church and any institution like it only has power that we give it. And you don't recognize that in the beginning. You know, one of the things people have asked me a lot over the years, it breaks my heart. I'll be at like a conference or something. Somebody comes sitting next to me and they're like, you know, I really miss prayer. They'll say to me, it was so such a wonderful thing. And I'm just feeling the loss of it. And I always say, it works exactly the same as it did before. Why stop?
So true.
You know, why do you have to give up? Because they feel like anything that's Mormon, anything from that sphere, has to go out. And I, the pictures that are triggering to me, you'll see ex-Mormons post on social media pictures of them throwing all their stuff in the dumpster, their garments, their temple. Their temple clothes, they throw all of their missionary scriptures. And there was a time when I said, don't do it. Now I just watch, because everyone's on their own journey. And for some people, that might be a very important thing to do. But if they ask me, again, I have to have these unsolicited advice things because nobody ever asked me for advice. But if you know, I'd say put it all in a box, put tape around it, because I have my temple apron. I haven't been to the temple. That was my grandfather's. Oh, yeah. It's meaningful to me. And someday they may not be around anymore. And I'll be glad that I have it. I don't see it negatively. I didn't see it negatively when I wore it. I see it as part of my weird culture. All cultures are weird. And it's a connection to my grandfather, who when he was in his 80s, he's my home teaching companion. And I love that thing. And I won't get rid of it. No one can have it. It's mine. It's meaningful to me, and I'm so glad I didn't get rid of it. Now, I got rid of other stuff that wasn't meaningful to me, but that's a connection to who I am and to my past, and that is not something that I'm in a place to process when I'm leaving the church.
I think that's awesome. Yeah. that you're feeling that kind of connection back to your grandpa through that. That's awesome.
Well, they're my people for good or for bad. And you know, when I look at this place we live, because there's this rift that I'm trying to figure out. I have no idea. I'm no prophet. I'm no leader. There's this rift in our community. But you know what? We all go to the same schools. I'm talking ex-Mormons and Mormons and everyone else. We go to the same concerts. We shop at the same stores. We live in the same houses. If an anthropologist came to study Utah from Mongolia, they would catch the fact that some people in Utah drink alcohol and some people don't, but I don't think they would be able to spot these differences. And I've had ex-Mormons tell me they have nothing in common with Mormons. And I would say to most of us, we are indistinguishable from each other, from anybody else who's not like versed in the nuances of our little culture. And as ex-Mormons, because we had to shoulder our own like religious ethical thing, that's not fun to hear. It's not fun to hear say, you know, you're still what they raised you to be. Because none of us want to hear that. We all want to get away from our parents as fast and as far as we can.
But I do think there is still value. And I think once you do let all of the dust settle, you can see the value in how you were raised and what you were taught. And there are some positives to it.
Mostly positives.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my ward growing up, that's still my family. You know, I still love these people, and it feels like going to a family reunion if I go to my parents' ward Halloween party or whatever. I still, you know, these are my people. I love them. They were like family to me growing up, and I love that connection that I have with them.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Anson Park, Executive Director of the Sunstone Education Foundation. I want to invite you to our weekly Sunstone Firesides. Do you remember those? Firesides that they used to have dating all the way back to the 1930s, when the LDS Church would hold monthly meetings to discuss really important gospel topics. Those meetings became known endearingly as Firesides. In January of 2019, Sunstone launched a new podcast that incorporates a nod to these Firesides, featuring a weekly evening podcast. It will display a range of hosts, all women, as they chat with diverse guests from across the Mormon spectrum. The hosts are all female-identifying that represent a broad perspective in Mormonism. These podcasts will be released every Thursday evening, so you can have that fireside feel brought right into your living room. So grab a cup of cocoa or coffee, since at Sunstone there is more than one way to Mormon. Snuggle up under a blanket and listen to incredible interviews by and from incredible people. You can support women and their work in Mormon studies, which is desperately needed, by donating at sunstone.org or becoming a monthly subscriber. Go to sunstone.org and click on the podcast tab for more info. We hope you enjoy it as much as we do.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the sins of the ex-Mormons. Specifically, let's start with booze. So of course, the word of wisdom is such a defining thing because it's so visual. Well, let's start with coffee because coffee's kind of funny.
Oh man,
you know you're an XX Mormon when coffee is a beverage. Because you
instead of a gateway drug,
you get onto the ex-Mormon sites, like you go to Reddit or whatever. Man, they talk about coffee, like they'll post pictures, and they're cute. I'm not trying to shame anybody. There's no shame here. That, you know, like their first little thing at Starbucks, and you can just see they're like shaking, and they feel so naughty, you know. And you have to remind yourself when you've been out of line, like what are they? Oh yeah, you can't drink coffee. I remember. And both Mormons and ex-Mormons are convinced that the world pays attention to their beverage choices all the time. Like Mormons are convinced that if they get milk in a bar, that nobody thinks they're drinking. And ex-Mormons oftentimes feel this need to, and sometimes they can be quite enabling. Like they want to make sure everybody at a party is drinking, you know, in unhealthy ways, because they're both obsessed with this in a way. But indulge it. Coffee's a great place to start. It's wonderful.
I know I had to hide my coffee when I first when I first came out. It was like this embarrassment. I didn't because we measure each other up by what's on our sleeves in the church so much, right? Uh-huh. I mean, are you wearing the? It was the smiley face garments, okay? Mm-hmm. When I was in the swooping.
The front. Mormon smile.
Yeah, the Mormon smile, and you could tell, you know, from 10 yards if they were in or not, or if they're walking around with a cup of coffee, you know, there's something going on here, and I lived that side of it. It's kind of weird to get comfortable in your own skin again, mm-hmm. For fear of what other people are thinking. You know, that lasts for a little while, I have to tell you.
Coffee is so funny for me because I come from old, like, southern Utah stock. My parents were teetotalers. They never drank coffee. But their parents did. And so it's not that far removed from Mormons who actually drank coffee.
That is such a fascinating thing to me. So I'm a nurse at the U, and so we get all kinds of people from the surrounding four or five states. And so I remember having this patient, active Mormon people from southern Utah, they had their coffee maker there in the room with them. It was like what they did every morning. And I thought that was so fascinating. But being out longer and seeing more of the world, like, oh man, coffee is so great. And it's not just being, you know, not having it for the first 35 years of my life. I talked to a Nevermo the other day, and she was like, oh, it's just this little piece of, you know, your warm coffee, and there's something so beautiful about it. Ex-Mormons feel that way. Non-Mormons feel that way. I wish that the non-Southern Utah Mormons could also feel that way, because it's a great, great thing.
Coffee makes my life better. I love coffee.
Makes my life
You're
better.
Drinking sunshine. I mean, this is
nothing better than coffee.
No, whenever I meet people who are not Mormon who don't drink coffee, but I think, but why? What is it about coffee that you don't like? I think I knew as a believing member that I would always that I would like coffee if I was like I would say. If I wasn't Mormon, I would totally drink coffee because I knew the flavor of it—the coffee nips and coffee ice cream. Like my parents weren't super strict about that.
So our advice to ex-Mormons or Mormons is go crazy on the coffee, man.
As soon as possible.
As soon as possible. the biggest problem you're going to find is that as a Mormon, if you're really active Mormon, you have a diminished palate. In that, when I grew up in the Mormon culture, I never ran into the flavor bitter or dry. I didn't know what either of those things were. So you have to kind of develop a taste for it. And people say sometimes, well, why would I want to develop a taste for coffee? Because it's good.
Because it's amazing.
And it's a better way to get caffeine than soda.
Right.
Oh my gosh. But, Diet Coke.
But,
in
okay,
Utah.
Here's my deep, dark confession that maybe I'll end up having stricken from the podcast.
Uh-oh.
I don't like coffee.
That's okay. I'm sorry. Not everybody has to like it. And some people say, I drink tea. Totally fine. But I just, it has made my life better.
I'm sad that the tea boys left the state to go to graduate school because I think a lot of ex-Mormons brush or bridge over tea too fast. Tea's a wonderful beverage, and my day is coffee, tea, then scotch, and then whatever else I'm going to take before I go to bed. So there's a moon phase cycle for me in the day of which sins I'm committing. But coffee's a good one. And don't stop posting your pictures. They're adorable to all of us. When you're a 30-year-old man out there posting your brave picture on Reddit with you and your coffee mug, you go. You make us all happy. All right, so let's talk about alcohol. One of the issues that strikes me now is I've been, as Steve, you pointed out, I've been involved in these sort of communities of helping people leave the church, or not helping them leave the church, helping support them after they leave, for a lot of years now. So I've been able to watch people as they go through these phases. The alcoholism starts hitting about 10 years later. So I'm now unfortunately at the stage where I can see the devastation that alcohol has on their lives. I want to personally say I do not believe that alcohol, I haven't seen any evidence that alcohol has a more devastating effect on the ex-Mormon community than communities at large. And Mormonism is interesting because you can struggle with the same problems. There's lots of adultery inside Mormonism. There's lots of addiction. There's lots of, we can see, there's lots of opioid addiction. But oftentimes those, they have structure to keep those things quiet. So if I'm having an affair and I go talk to my bishop, it will all be kind of on the down low. For with ex-Mormon, some of this stuff is brought out to the forefront. So it allows people to look at ex-Mormon and say, see them struggling with alcohol. Where if you look around a little bit more, you'll say, yeah, but see all the Mormons struggling with alcohol. So you're blaming alcohol addiction or problem drinking on leaving the church. But in my experience, I see most of the problem drinking happening years after people leave. I see binge drinking problems that surface immediately. And I know you've all probably seen that probably all in your own homes.
So many times, first with so many different people.
There is an element where ex-Mormons sometimes want to push other ex-Mormons into drinking and sampling just peer pressure. It's the same thing that happens in junior high school. Like you feel validated because other people are doing your same choices.
I kind of wonder if it's every member a missionary, and so why not every ex-member a missionary? This alcohol is so great. I like how relaxed I feel. Oh, look, you have this hang up on it. I feel like if I was to proselyte the joys of alcohol, then you would see this wonderful thing as well.
And plus, you're so kind of not educated in alcohol and don't have a clue as to what to order and things like that. So when you get in a party situation, people are offering different things. It's like, oh, I don't have to go buy a whole bottle to taste what rum tastes like or whatever it may be. So some of that I think makes sense that you could sample and kind of find what appeals to you. But in the end, the most important thing is the responsibility side of drinking. People say things and do things that they'll say alcohol is what made them do it. I think that's a poor excuse. I just really do.
I think alcohol, it enables certain elements of your personality, but I don't think you'll do anything that's not in there. It might lower your self-restraint, so you might do things normally your Jiminy Cricket would tell you not to. But those stories are overblown. Like and unfortunately what happens, I think the most negative trait, well, I want to put that on the table for a minute. I think what happens here is the general way people left the church over the last 20 years is they would go online and find groups. And they would find connection with strangers online. And this happens in all sorts of things today. And I'm not trying to be critical of that. And then they would come to a point where they're ready to kind of come out. And unfortunately, the only avenue for a lot of years before you folks start building something better, because you guys in Davis County actually started doing like brunches, didn't you?
Yeah,
just to combat this problem.
Yeah, we would do ladies' brunches. We would also do family picnics in the park, all kinds of family-friendly gatherings, which is that's one of the things we've learned from in the last 10 years, because the first few years, it was a lot of parties.
Because that's all there was. It was mm-hmm. the easiest way right. to so, meet other people, is to throw a party.
Yeah, and so we would have a lot of trouble because we were never taught the difference between binge drinking and a glass of wine. And so in our world, drinking a glass of wine is the same thing as complete alcoholism. So we're still trying to figure out what is responsible alcohol use. So the parties would usually get out of hand. People would drink too much and get sick. So something that we've started doing in the last couple of years is instead of having it be parties like that, we have it be family picnics or family brunches. And so it's a family-friendly thing so that people can talk and not have to worry about things getting out of control.
I remember one party, Jim and I were there probably about 11:30. We had as many garbage cans as we could. We were going, sticking them underneath people. And now there's people who are going to hear what I just say, and they're going to frame that poorly. What in most instances when I've seen and been to parties, and I've been to parties at your house and I've been to parties at your house, the environment, we talk about people getting sick, but they're in a very loving, supporting place to do it. And I think what, unfortunately, one of the reputations ex-Mormons get is somebody will come to one of these parties and see all these like 40-year-olds and 30-year-olds like drunk and saying crazy things and, you know, dancing and kissing. And they're like, oh my God, this is Babylon, right? And it's not. And it's people like learning to do this the same way most people learn this in college. And I think most of the drama I've seen in the ex-Mormon community is actually not from people doing X, Y, or Z. It's from the community blowing up afterwards as we kind of take that Mormon instinct to police one another and apply that to things we're not fully comfortable with. I've seen things at parties I'm not fully comfortable with. And I've seen things at parties I wasn't fully comfortable with until I started doing them, and then they were really awesome. But I think there's a, more so than alcohol being a problem, it's this problem of us policing one another.
Yeah. I don't think that that is strictly a Mormon thing. I think that's a human thing. We police each other. We watch, what are you doing there? And, you know, I think you're doing it wrong. And no, you're doing it wrong. But I think that Mormons have a special corner on that market. So.
Right. And you do the problem that one of the problems ex-Mormons face is that they think everybody who's an ex-Mormon is a friend. People leave the church for a lot of reasons. There's people who leave the church because they're child molesters. There's people who leave the church because they're fraudsters. There's people who leave the church because they're nuts. And you have this, because in the church we felt this affinity, same sort of thing. Well, wherever I go, in whatever ward I move into, I have a family there. And a lot of ex-Mormons think the same thing is true. And you know what? 98% of the cases, you're right, that the people are good people and they're friendly and they'll take care of you. But there are predators in the ex-Mormon community. And almost all of us who have had parties, you and Greg and I were talking about this just a couple days ago, they oftentimes will have parties to be open and generous with their homes, and they shut them down because they don't want to enable predatory behaviors.
Well, I don't know that I saw predatory behavior so much. I want to say, by and large, parties that we had at our house, I was happy and... I shouldn't say surprised. Maybe I was like expecting good things. And for the most part, good things mostly happened. It was one party where we opened it up to friends and friends of friends that it, you know, it was a little more out of control than I wanted. But for the most part, I feel like people were pretty respectful. I don't think that we were ever really going for an ex-Mormon vibe. Like, I love the term post-Mormon. Post-Mormon feels more comfortable to me. And it feels like where I have been, but the crazy parties, I don't know that I have really, I've never been to the ones where people are wearing their garments on the outside and drinking shots out of the, you know, sacrament.
I have.
No, I'm sure you have. I know that they exist. But I just don't know that we personally were seeking them out.
I'll tell you, I think of some of the craziest parties I've been to, that they were a lot of people who I wouldn't classify as like ex-Mormons. You know, they were people who quit the church when they were 17 and they've been like dealing heroin for the past 20 years. You know, technically they are ex-Mormons. That's what I'm saying is you might have a party that suddenly becomes an open party on Facebook, and you do legitimately have somebody show up who thinks they're going to sell a little Molly that night. And that is a phase of growing up. It's a part of the church where we're taught to over trust Mormons and not trust anybody else. So it's that same flip we're talking about. You become an ex-Mormon, so you don't trust Mormons, you trust everyone else. That is a recipe for disaster. If your mode of trusting people in this world is the fact that they're not members of the church or they were former members of the church, there's a lot of people who get excommunicated for really good reasons. So not everybody there is your friend, but most of them are. And I don't think there's more predators in the ex-Mormon community than there are like in the world in general. It's kind of that same thing. They're ex-Mormons who struggle with alcoholism. They're Mormons who struggle with alcoholism. They're Catholics who study alcoholism. Alcoholism is a problem for a certain percentage of the population. But it's not caused by leaving the church, and it's definitely not caused by drinking. But by just being an ex-Mormon. But if you were a faithful Mormon for 30 years, and then you start drinking at 35, and you develop a dependency on alcohol at 40, your family is going to blame your leaving the church on it. No, there's no question.
So with alcohol, there are always these kinds of parties, right? And those aren't going to stop.
They always have been, yeah. And there always will be, whether or not you're ex-Mormon. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And so offering a spectrum of events and activities that will allow those who want to go party, others who would really like to maybe learn about alcohol. You could do a workshop of some sort. We've done this kind of thing in Salt Lake Valley and Utah Valley quite often. And it's usually pretty popular. People sign up. It's like, I want to get educated. I don't even know what the different kinds of beer are or wine or what have you. But the other thing is that beyond the parties, there can be other kinds of ways of getting together. Coffee meetups, there's all kinds of ways to get together. And it's such a vital part. We kind of have touched on this a little bit, but a vital part of when you leave the church is you've left community. And there's a gaping hole that usually opens up that feels vacuous. And finding other people in person. Online is awesome. You really do get a sense of community online, but it's that and then some when you're in person, because you've got a pair of eyes that you can look into as they're telling you the stories that they've gone through, or come to you with some situation they've bumped into with a loved one who's believing, and it's just wrecking their hearts. You could just see it. So being there in person and giving space for that is awesome. And so there need to be events that allow for that as well.
I think so. And Wendy, you were hinting at that, and it's something I learned. And I think one of the biggest failings of the ex-Mormon community as a broader community is we haven't been as good at creating family, especially teenagers. We've really failed teenagers. There's been a lot of activities where they have kids, and a lot of these parties, they'll actually have kids there and babysitters, and they're not as terrible as we make them sound, but I think we need is more folks who are willing to not just open their home and have a party on Friday night. That's wonderful and it's fun, but we need more structure for people and their kids and their family, and recognize that there are alcoholics in the community, and there are people who have opioid addictions, and there are people who struggle with these real sort of things. In the last few years, I've kind of hinted on the podcast that my kids were going through some real mental health issues that took a lot of energy, and I recognized that even though I have lots of friends and I know I have a lot of people that if I picked up the phone, they would do whatever I asked for them. But during this time, I didn't have the structure because I didn't go to church. So if people aren't seeing me on Facebook, they don't know if I'm like touring New Zealand or I'm dead, right? But I didn't know what to ask. I needed something. I needed more support. And I had friends who were there and were there for me, but I needed something and it wasn't there. And I don't fault anybody. There was no way for me to even say, because I didn't know what to ask for. So I think outside of the drinking, what we all have to do is get better at building those community interconnections that span whatever's going to happen in your life. And that's something that I would say for those of us who've been out for a long time, I'm challenging you to help build those things and help take care of help the next generation. For those who are fresh out, I'm saying seek those, and they don't have to be ex-Mormon. You can find meetup groups that do macrame. You can find hiking groups. You can find people who aren't talking about religion all the time. Ex-Mormons say they don't want to talk about Mormonism. Then they spend all their time in ex-Mormon groups like talking about Mormonism. Listen, I have to follow Mormonism for this podcast. The single fastest, best way to find out what's going on in the Mormon world is to talk to the ex-Mormons who insist that they don't want anything to do with Mormonism, because they know every little thing that's going on all the time. And I'm saying it's okay to process that, nothing wrong with that, but it's okay to let that go and find yourself some hobby that has nothing to do with Mormonism.
It's nice to have a community for like you said, when you need help, it's nice to have people you can fall back on, or if you're going to move, that you have people that will help you move couches, or if somebody has a baby or is sick, it's nice to have people bring in meals. And I think when you do leave, you kind of have to find a new group of people for that. Otherwise, it can be really, really isolating when hard stuff happens.
And you've always stayed really involved with the Girl Scouts.
Yes, and Boy Scouts and Cub Scouts. So I did have help with that. I had surgery recently, and through my various friend networks, we had people bring in meals for my family for 3 weeks for us. And And if I hadn't had these communities, I don't know what we would have done. It would have been really, really hard for us to have made, you know, gotten through that time without these communities that we had built for ourselves.
Hi, I'm Stephen Carter. My job is great. I get to gather the best articles, essays, stories, and poems from Sunstone Magazine and narrate them for the Sunstone Magazine podcast. It's the best of Mormonism in an audible quality recording. Some of the people Sunstone has published include D. Michael Quinn, Jana Reese, Gregory A. Prince, Elna Baker, Dan Weatherspoon, Gina Colvin, and John Gustav Rathal. Head over to patreon.com/sunstone to listen to some of our free episodes. And then, join us for the best of Mormon thought and experience.
All right, should we talk about sex? Okay, so the Mormon Church is obsessed with sex. And, you know, even words, if I say a word like moral, if you grew up in the Mormon paradigm, that means sex. If I say a word like value, that means sex. If I say a word like worthy, that means sex. If I say a word like virtue, that means sex. So you have a religion that imbues everything with controlling sexuality. What you can do, what you can't do. You can't do this, you can't do this, you have to do this. You have to have our sanction to do this. If you do this thing, you're out. We'll shame you. We'll take, you can't take the sacrament. You can't get up and pray. It's just ever present. You mix that with people who oftentimes, by design, you can't date before you're 16. When you're 16, you have to group date. We're going to send you on a mission when you're 18. We're going to send you to the church school, and you can't have anybody of the opposite sex in your apartment after 10 o'clock. You have to have your bedroom door open. It's very common for people to have their very first sexual experience with the person they marry 6 days later. You know, literally, so
5 months. I had five whole months.
Which is not, I'm not, I was there. I'm not making fun of it. You, what's the old phrase? You do not have sex. Sex has you. And your body and your psychology and your mentality. What, are you okay over there? it wants to have sex, but I'm gonna lay out a problem here. You had zero sexual experience except with the person you married. You are married to them for 15, 20 years. You lose your faith in Mormonism, and maybe you lose your faith in religion altogether. It doesn't matter. But sexuality has been a key component of everything that you've believed up until this point. You know, like when I after I left the church, I became a Unitarian for 5 years, and it was fascinating to see a church that ostensibly ran very similarly that Mormon Church ran, except it didn't give two shits about sex at all. It didn't care. It just wasn't part of the venue, you know?
Not only that. I mean, we put our two older kids in the OWL program, which was amazing. Fantastic. And I have felt bad that I kind of missed it with my younger two. Maybe it's still going to happen. I don't know. But great program. Seek out the OWL program through the Unitarians.
Excellent. Thank you. And South Valley Unitarian does one. Mm-hmm. And I know the gentleman who does it, South Valley, he's fantastic. First Church does it too. Mm-hmm. I don't know if in Ogden, but almost every Unitarian congregation, no matter where you are listening to this, and Unitarians do not discriminate based on religion. From a Unitarian perspective, you're all Unitarians. So you can go get involved in the OWL program, whether or not you join the Unitarian Church. So yeah, thanks
little plug for that. Yeah, OWL stands for our whole lives and just kind of follows sexuality through. You know, it starts for second grade if that church is running that through adulthood. They have different programs, but the one we hit was the fifth and sixth grade program for our two older kids.
Excellent. So they won't run into the problem that a lot of us ran into, which was being very naive about sexuality, actually being told things that are wrong about sexuality your whole life, having this religious structure fall down around you, and being in a world where everything is permitted. And sometimes people are in a marriage, sometimes that marriage, a lot of marriages fall apart, or I should say end. You know, I think we should celebrate the end of marriages instead of mourn them. They fall apart because the marriage was primarily based on their identity and role in the church. And when they no longer have that identity and role in the church, then the marriage starts losing its primary function. So you have a lot of people who have to redefine their sexual ethic on their own. And that is not an easy thing to navigate for anybody, no matter what they do. I think this one is a big question for everybody, no matter what they do. Because you're probably, if you go through a faith crisis, you're going to look at your significant other and you're going to say, are you going to be the only person I ever have sex with for the rest of my life? And especially if you give up the idea of immortality, that can be a heavy thing. And sexuality is important to us, important to who we are. And it's a bodily thing. And it's something that ex-Mormons have to struggle through. And my first thing here before we go in and tell funny stories is to plead with everybody to be gentle with everybody. This is a hard thing to navigate. And there's a lot of tendency to gossip and blow up people and rumor monger and suggest that ex-Mormons, you know, have no morals, or they, you know, they're too this, that, or the other. And I'm saying this is a really difficult thing to get through. You guys, I'll have to be careful because you don't want to incriminate yourself or seem like, I don't care. I figured a couple of years ago, they're going to say what they're going to say about me, and half it's true and half it's false, and half the things they don't say are false and half the things they don't say are true. So what do I care? So we get ex-Mormons to start having recreational sex. The first thing that tends to happen is they get drunk and make out at parties with people who aren't their spouses. Then that's sometimes that behavior needs to be stemmed. And it does, because people will make poor choices on alcohol sometimes that they'll wake up the next day. And I'm sure all of you have redirected people who are about to make really poor life choices.
Definitely. But one of the things that I found, and I don't, is there's a lot of shame with sex and sexual desire and in the Mormon world. And so a lot of people, as they're processing out, have to work through those issues and try to not be ashamed of what they want or what their needs are, and that it's okay to like sex and have fun. I was lucky enough to be raised in a very sex-positive household within the bonds of marriage, of course. But beyond that, I felt like I don't have a lot of the hang-ups that a lot of the other people do. And nearly everybody I talk to, as they're processing out, are trying to get rid of those hang-ups that they have and this sense of shame for wanting these things.
I wrote an essay years ago that I pop up every once in a while. I should do it again. The title is basically, discretion is the better part of success. But basically I argue that oftentimes you don't know who's doing what in this world. And people who are successful at things, there are a lot of people out there in this world today, inside and outside the church, it's nothing to do with Mormonism, who are involved in all sorts of things that you don't know about. There's a lot of swingers out there and polyamorous people and people who they don't have sex with their primary partner anymore, but they have a girlfriend on the side, and that is really super common. And the problem is ex-Mormons have this issue with promiscuous disclosure. I say it's an issue because neither good nor bad. What happens is secrecy is used to control people inside the church. So ex-Mormons say, I'm never going to be controlled by silence anymore. So I'm going to tell everybody all the time everything I'm doing. And so there's also this issue that people like to talk about these things constantly because they're trying to process through it. There is some mess that happens outside the church with sexuality. And yes, there is a lot of mess that happens inside the church with sexuality. There's a lot of affairs and things, but again, like I said a few minutes ago, oftentimes that gets brushed under the rug. But there is no rug in the ex-Mormon world. So I think some of this stuff happens. So since this is the advice show, what advice, as people are getting out there and ready to explore their own sexuality and don't know their own boundaries, what would you all tell them?
I would say talk to your partner, because I don't know if anyone listens to Dan Savage's Savage Love Cast, but I thought one thing that he really talks about a lot, he hits this point a lot, is that monogamy has always been the default in heterosexual relationships, but he's saying you guys need to talk about this more. You heterosexual people, you need to talk about what your relationship is going to be. Is it going to be monogamous? Is it going to be open? Because there's kind of more of a default in, I don't want to generalize for everyone, but there seems to be more of an acceptance of more open relationships, in homosexual relationships, where heterosexual, well, we marry, so we must be monogamous. And so I think that that's an interesting point, that maybe as you are leaving the church, that is one thing that you need to talk about. Is this still where we are? Because if you are going and having, you know, you're like, well, anything goes now. If you're going and saying, well, you can easily blow up a really great marriage because you're going to do what you're going to do. You there's no more boundaries. You can have sex with whoever you want until, you know, your husband or wife goes, but I'm still here and we haven't talked about what's happening.
I think that's great advice. And I really like the part, you know, you're talking about words and the same thing going back to the church. We don't have the mechanism to discuss these. We don't have the vocabulary. And I second the opinion on Dan Savage's podcast. I'd recommend that people leaving the church are exploring that, because Dan Savage explores every issue of sexuality. Every issue. You're going to hear about everything if you listen
more
to
more than you want to, maybe.
Absolutely fascinating. It's the most interesting thing I do all week, is listening to that. But to recognize the tools you need to talk about sex, and recognize that sex has a lot of emotion involved. And you can't avoid that emotion by avoiding sex, because it's integrated into who we are. And couples can have the same mistake. They can destroy a good relationship by not talking about it, by not expressing their wants and desires. And for a lot of people, they come out of the church and realize, you know what? I might be pansexual. I might be bisexual. I might need space to explore those. And let me tell you, there are many, many thousands of people who successfully do that. I know lots of Mormons or both. I know Mormons and ex-Mormons who are successful swingers. I know Mormons and ex-Mormons who are successful polyamorous people. I know people who have all kinds of different flavors of relationships. And I know plenty of monogamous relationships that are terrible. There's no guarantee. This is the lie the church told you, that if you do X, Y, and Z, everything will be fine. That's not true, which is both exhilarating and scary. Because there's not necessarily a guarantee that you can save your marriage by doing X, Y, and Z. The only thing close is, like you were saying, is learning to talk to one another.
I agree with the talking to one another. I think also, as you kind of, as shame goes away and the aperture opens up as to what's possible, and authenticity is where it comes in there. It's like, who are you authentically? Stop trying to be things that you aren't. And so that kind of evaluation makes a big difference. The other thing is, I agree with communication, but within that is consent.
Right.
And that's so vital, because, again, we've all witnessed, you know, people drinking too much and someone being a little too forward. And I think we all have to be on the lookout, because that's just further devastation that would be caused.
Yeah, I think it's true. I've been sexually assaulted at least 20 times. At ex-Mormon parties. I've had my ass grabbed. I've had my testicles grabbed. I've been pushed. I've been shoved. I've been forcibly kissed. I'm okay. but it's not okay. Right. And I think that there is a problem. And I know I don't want to get mad, so I'm not going to do on the women who know their names in the ex-Mormon world. They've had it worse. Mm-hmm. We have a problem in this community with sexual assault, and that's on both genders. Almost all my sexual assault came from women. Come on, guys. I'm attractive to men, right? I'm feeling left out. thanks, Steve.
I was reaching over
for
his knee.
I think we were taught so much about what we can't do that I don't think we were taught enough about consent and enthusiastic consent and how vitally important that is.
So sometimes I felt like it's time not just talking. So you need consent before you touch anybody, unless it's a social, like a greeting hug, a handshake. If you're going to touch anybody, maybe I'll give you a pass if you touch them above the elbow and below the shoulder. That's the only place that you can touch them, but never do it more than once. If you're going to kiss somebody, you should ask them beforehand. If you're going to insert anything into their body, you need to ask them beforehand, even if you've received previous consent. So please take my advice. to always ask consent before you touch anybody, always ask advice before you kiss anybody, and always ask advice before you do anything, and before you have intercourse, before you stick your penis in anything. It needs to give you an enthusiastic consent.
And remember that consent has to be done when you're of sound mind. If somebody has been drinking a lot, they cannot give consent, so you can't do anything. If you think they're drunk, you really shouldn't be having anything to do with that, because they cannot give consent.
I agree. And the last thing, any other things about sex? I know it's not the funnest thing to talk about, but be...
I mean, it is, but it's tricky.
Not like this.
tricky.
But I admonish all of us, be gentle and forgiving for other people's sexual journeys.
Yeah.
That just because it might not be for you to go do these things, that there are some people who receive great fulfillment from those, and there is no one answer. That's the beauty of life after the church. There is no one answer for all of us. There are people who will have thousands of sex partners, and that will be joyful and fulfilling for them. There are people who have one, and that will be joyful and fulfilling, and neither of those is right or wrong. But, you know, my life philosophy now is do whatever you want, but do it with good manners. And if you're doing things, if you're engaging with other people with good manners, you're not going to take advantage of them. You're going to have enthusiastic consent, as you said.
And diversity is beautiful. I mean, right? I mean, mm-hmm. It's great.
And I would also say be gentle with yourself. Don't try to shame yourself. Let yourself explore who you are sexually and what you want. And there's not a wrong answer there if you like this or this and you were taught that was wrong. You work through that so that you can embrace who you are sexually.
And I think it's a really good point. And, you know, I keep talking about like this 10-year horizon and this 5-year horizon. I think there's a lot of ex-Mormons who spent some time exploring this, that, or the other and found it wasn't for them. And that's okay. You can go two routes in life. You can pony up to some sort of religion that tells you exactly what's in and what's out, what you can do and what you can't, what you can touch and what you can't. That's okay. That's an all right way to live your life. Or you explore your own boundaries. And you explore your own boundaries by finding them and saying, Jesus, I don't want to do that anymore. Like, that's not for me. I don't like that. And that's okay, too. Just, again, try not to hurt people. And when you hurt people, try to make it better as well, as best you can, and move on. We're not, and Wendy, you keep making this point, it's a good one. We're not defined by the fact that we were Mormon or the fact that we had a threesome in the 80s or whatever it was. We're all human beings, and we can move beyond those things. All right, we've talked about a lot of things. I'm going to go around the room and let you kind of give your last piece of advice. Think about those people who are insisting right now that everything's okay, but they're really kind of struggling. What if they were going to listen to you, what would you tell them? Steve?
So I'd start with look at the difference between beliefs and people. You can have different beliefs, but still have a connection to each other. And there are some relationships where that's a lot more vital than others. Familial relationships, very good close friends. This rift that can open up between you in terms of what you believe in can affect your relationship. And I think it's the onus is really on the post-Mormon to bridge that gap as much as possible. We're the ones who know what it's like to be a Mormon, know what it's like to be on the other side of it. You can imagine half of the pain that you feel is imagining the pain that mother or someone else feels in your absence in believing. And so if you can kind of understand that there's real pain on both sides of it, and that you want the relationship to survive, then you'll be doing things that will help make that so, and not doing other things that would not make that so, if that makes sense. I think I may have thrown in some extra knots. But the idea is value the relationship. Now, not all relationships should be valued. Some of them are poisonous and broken, and that's up to you to decide which relationships matter to you. But I promise you there will be relationships that matter to you that for whom this will be a difficult thing to navigate. All I can emphasize is value the relationship and do all you can to keep it intact.
I agree 100%. Letty?
I would say find your people, because not all of the ex-Mormons or the post-Mormons are going to be your people. So to echo what Steve said earlier, face-to-face, like online is great. And it is so helpful for so many people, especially as you're first coming out, you're researching, you can talk with people. I know, did you know this? I didn't know this. But then after that, get face-to-face with people, go to parties, find who your people are. Because in our first couple of years, first, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years, we hosted parties, but we also had a lot of smaller dinner parties where we got to know people on a more individual level, because a big party is great, but you don't get to know people in the same way. And having 6 or 8 people around your table being able to sit and talk is huge. Now, I will say I am in the lucky position of having a husband who is a wonderful cook. And so it's maybe easier for us, and we like to host. But however you do it, however you get together with people, and I wish that we would have kept like a list of all the people that we hosted and, you know, talked to and got to know, because there's so many people that we had over one time, and you know, they lived in a different place. They moved on to do whatever they were going to do. But I'm so happy that we found so many good friends through doing that, through hosting, through talking. And I feel like we have found, you know, a great group of people. And that has been huge for us.
Fantastic.
I think my biggest advice would be to be kind. Be kind to the others going through this journey with you. Be kind to the people who are in your life that still believe, and try to look at things from their perspective. If you are starting to go through this crisis as a married person and your spouse still believes, it can be extremely painful and difficult, because it can feel like a rejection of the marriage. Because, I mean, maybe this was just me, but growing up, I was always taught a marriage was between 3 people, me, my spouse, and the church, or God, Heavenly Father, Jesus. And so if you start rejecting this one tenet, it could feel like you're rejecting the marriage altogether, and you're completely changing up all the rules. And that can be really scary for your spouse, and really isolating, and feel like they don't love you anymore. So try to keep the marriage strong. Try to reassure them, no, I still do love you. I just am trying to parse this other aspect of my life out. And if they're not ready to leave, try to make that be okay. You know, try to have other people that you can talk to about this, so that they're not the one hearing all of your anger and betrayal, and they're not in a position where they have to feel like they have to defend the church, because that can be a really difficult place.
Excellent. I think my advice would be that your experience, how you processed it, how you've got through it matters. You matter. Your voice matters. And there's others who will benefit from you and from knowing you. And, you know, in the church, we were kind of fortunate to have a structure that allowed us to serve other people and allowed us to be more generous than we might have been. Almost every ex-Mormon to a person will acknowledge, I don't give as much as I did when I did in the church. I don't give as much time. And my message to everybody, no matter where you are in the journey, is there's others who need your help. There's others who can learn from what you're doing. And just like we've heard, and the folks around this table were all generous in opening their hearts and their homes to people. And I think you all agree that it enriched your life. We talked about a little bit about some of the negative experiences, but those are just crumbs on a really wonderful life experience that happened because we were willing to crawl out of the basement and make ourselves vulnerable and find out that there are others who needed to hear from us. And I've seen that with each and every one of you, that you've touched people's lives in ways that matter. And to everybody out there listening, we need you. We need, the only way we're going to get over this rift of pain and all the anger and outrage is for us to just make connections with each other who are leaving the church, but people who are back. And that's the problem in our society, not just in the church, but what's going on in the United States today, and what's going on in the world today, is this us and them sort of thing. And there is no them. It's only us. And there's people who need you. And you probably feel like your voice doesn't matter. You don't have interesting things to say. But there's, I guarantee you, there's people out there who need to hear what you have to say. So it's another call for action. And unfortunately, I don't always know what that action is. Sure, come out to Sunstone Conference. It's a great, a safe place to meet people. There's no alcohol at the main conference. There's really interesting people. There's other things just like this. There's other organizations who put on retreats, and there's the Oasis group. There's the Unitarian churches. Hell, any church in the valley is full of ex-Mormons, you know, and you can find your people. But more importantly, you matter to those people, and you are important.
I can't agree more that you matter and your story matters. And there are lots of ways of getting your story out. But as far as finding others who are like-minded, I want to put a plug in for the Mormon Spectrum website. www.mormonspectrum.org/map will get you to a map of in-person communities. There are over 250 of them. I put them all on the map. People register groups. So if you have a group that isn't on the map and you'd like to get it on the map, go to that website in general and you'll find out how to do it. But the great thing is there are lots of groups that already exist. And so some of you may not even know that. You may not live in Utah. You may live somewhere else. And these are all over the states. Basically, wherever you find Mormons in any extensive population centers, you're going to find post-Mormon groups. Absolutely, come. Community does matter, and you matter to that community. So find a community.
I don't have anything to add. Any last word? All right. Again, I appreciate so much for you guys coming out. I probably should say there was a point here. There'll be a point when you're past the anger, you're past the rage, and what you maybe not hear, and what I can see with these individuals and many, many others like it, is the calmness that comes after a while. The rage and the all the things we talked about, that all passes. And you're left on the other side. Sure, the church is going to piss you off sometimes. It will the rest of your life. But it won't control you like it feels like it does. And I guess that's the last word is it will. It does get better.
It gets better.
Since we talked about Dan Savage, I mean, that was the Dan Savage project, the It Gets Better project. It gets better. And it'll get so much better if you can find community, find your people, find who you are.
You can be a phoenix.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks so much for coming in, guys. I appreciate it. And thanks to all you out there.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.